And to be able to do that, we've got to finish the book of Galatians tonight. But I think we can do it. We just have the last section of chapter 6, Galatians 6, verses 11 through 18. So just a few verses, and relatively easy verses, maybe, to look at. Paul's conclusion to this letter is different than any other closing of his epistles. That is, assuming that he did not write the book of Hebrews. We don't know who wrote the book of Hebrews. Sometimes it's speculated that he did. But if we take that out of the equation, because we don't know, the letters that we do know that Paul penned, most of the conclusions are very similar. That they have a more of a personal tone to them. He talks about maybe his travel plans. Mentions many times names of people. Somebody sends you greetings and tells somebody else this, that kind of thing that we would normally do in our letters. And then closes out with some doxology. Remember, a doxology is a short statement. Usually it's a verse or two of just praise. Praise be to God for, and we'll close it out that way. He doesn't do that in the book of Galatians. We don't really know why. We can speculate. Maybe this is most likely his first letter. And so maybe that custom picked up later. And also because of the subject matter that he's dealing with, that he does so. And maybe because it was such an early letter, there wasn't as much information of a personal nature to pass back and forth as there would be in the later one. So, but anyway, we'll look at the closing of this letter, and then time permitting, kind of wrap up the entire book. And wrap up this quarter. But let's begin with a word of prayer. Kind of quickly summarize chapter 6 here. Remember in verses 1 through 5, he stated those things which at first glance maybe looks like a contradiction, but when you look at the context, you see that it's not a contradiction. When he said for you to share one another's burdens and to bear your own burden. Remember we said in the original that's two different words. You have a work to do, and you be responsible for that work, not comparing it to somebody else, not simply saying, well, I'm doing more than they are. Simply do your work, what's been allotted unto you. But there are burdens that we can help one another share. In particular, in this context, well, let me ask you, in verses 1 through 5, what was the particular burden that he had in mind, according to verse 1? Somebody who has been overtaken, who is sin in their life. We have the responsibility to help them bear that burden. Now, again, we can't bear it in the sense that we don't have any absolution to give them, any kind of salvation to offer them, but we can go to them, as he said, in a spirit of gentleness, hopefully restoring that person. And so we have those obligations. Verse 6 through 10 kind of continues that same theme with the idea of telling us that we have the opportunity to do good. He concluded in verse 10, as we have opportunity, let us do good to all, especially those who are of the household of faith. That began in verse 6 with talking about the responsibility toward the teachers of the word, whether that's talking about a financial sharing, which I take it to be just because it's so similar to the other passages where Paul deals with that. But he says that there's a give and take here. They're giving something to you, you give something to them in return. And to not grow weary in doing good, because you're going to reap what you sow later on. And so you do good to all men, especially of the household of faith. We talked Sunday morning about how this verse is very controversial among brethren. So many of our brethren want to point to Galatians 6 verse 10 as the text that permits the local churches to be able to help what we call general benevolence out of the contribution. That simply it does not hold up really into biblical study because he's talking about individual action here. It's evident when you're talking about bearing one another's burdens, when you talk about sharing with those who teach. Earlier, he's talked about the sins that we can commit back in chapter 5, the works of the flesh and the fruit of the Spirit. Those are individual things. He talks about circumcision. That's not a congregational thing. That's an individual thing. And though these letters were written or addressed to a church, that most of what's being talked about is talking about the individuals of that church and the obligations that they would have. And so when we get to Galatians 6 verse 10, that's what he's talking about. As we have opportunity, let us do good to all, especially those who are the household of faith. The individual responsibility is what is being talked about there. Again, I want to look at this. I want to redo all of that we said. But go back, hold your finger there, and go to 1 Corinthians chapter 16. And as you're turning to 1 Corinthians 16, remember the book that we're studying was written to the churches of Galatia. The churches of Galatia, he addressed those churches and gave the individuals their obligations. Here, you practice this in your life. You don't be an adulterer. Again, as you're turning over there, think about that. One of the sins that he listed there as the work of the flesh was adultery. The congregation, how can a local church commit adultery? Well, they can't. The individuals can. When he talks about murder, I guess we could all, as a group, conspire together. The elders could call a meeting. We could decide that we're going to, as a group, kill somebody. But that's ridiculous. We know that's not what he's talking about. A local church being guilty of murder. Those are individual sins. Drunkenness. Those are things that are talking, obviously, to the individual. And so just because a letter is addressed to churches doesn't mean that everything that's talked about is talking about what they were to do when they were assembled together or do as a collective. And so when he says in Galatians 6, verse 10, again, to the churches of Galatia, he says, you do good to all, especially the household of faith. He's talking about individual action. Because in 1 Corinthians 16, verse 1, he says, now concerning the collection for the saints, as I have given orders to the churches of Galatia, that's the same people, the same book that we're talking about, so you must also do. So he says, now concerning the collection for the saints. Here it was obviously a congregational action, a collection that they were to take. Verse 2 says, on the first day of the week, let each one of you lay something aside, storing up as he may prosper, that there be no collections when I come. That's a corporate activity he's talking about. They are collections, laying by in store on the first day of the week, making a collection from the individuals as the congregation. But he said there, 1 Corinthians 16, verse 1, as I gave instructions to the churches of Galatia concerning the collection for the saints. And so when he's talking to the church of Galatia, churches of Galatia, about corporate activity or congregational activity, he calls it the collection for the saints. But then when he is talking to individuals in the book, Galatians 6, verse 10, that's a broader category is given to do good to all, especially those of the household of faith. Now, back to Galatians 6, verse 10, don't let that debate among brethren skew your view of that verse. There's nothing inherent in Galatians 6, verse 10 that says that that's only talking about financial assistance. Now, I think it would be included in it. It's broad enough. Do good to all. That would include if there's somebody, if you've got a next door neighbor who's not a member of the church and they have hard times, maybe their house burns down or some other kind of thing, you have, I think, a Christian obligation, if you have opportunity, to do good to them, to maybe give them some money or give them a refrigerator or buy them a lawnmower or whatever you can do. Give them food and that assistance. But don't limit it to money. Just because this has been a debate about who we can financially support and who we can't, do good would certainly include, if you've got that opportunity, but it would also go all the way back to verse 1. It would include caring for their soul. Now, you're not going to restore them because they're not a brother, but you could go to them with the gospel. That's doing good. You could help them in other ways to encourage them at a time of a loss or a time of sickness. And so don't limit it to just money. Now, it would include money or other material giving that you could do, but don't limit it to that. Do good in whatever opportunity that you find yourself. All right, chapter 6, verse 11 says, "See with what large letters I have written to you with my own hand." Now, a couple comments about that. We won't spend a whole lot of time on it because it doesn't have really any bearing upon anything doctrinal or practical we need to make in our lives. But I think it's important or interesting to note that the way letters were normally, like these letters were normally written, they were not normally written by Paul. We usually kind of talk of it in that way, don't we? Paul wrote the book of Galatians. But there was really an interesting chain of events here. When we say, you know, sometimes in questions, and I'm sure in our questions here, we might ask, who wrote the book of Galatians? Well, that's kind of a trick question, isn't it? Somebody say Paul, and we give you credit for that. Somebody else would say the Holy Spirit. Well, we'd have to give you credit for that, wouldn't we? Because Paul really didn't come up with the words, did he? And so the Holy Spirit did. Somebody else say God. Somebody else say Jesus. All those answers would be right. But somebody else could write, a scribe wrote the book. Because that seems to be what took place. Look over in the book of Romans, chapter 16. Someone read verse 22. Now, Ben's going to be teaching the book of Romans, and I didn't look at this outline. If he asked who wrote the book of Romans, I want somebody to mess with him and make this their answer. Somebody read Romans 16, verse 22. And I know you may have difficulty pronouncing that name. Just say it real fast.
Tertius, who wrote this epistle, greet you in the Lord.
Okay. Tertius, who wrote this epistle. Well, wait a minute. I thought Paul wrote this epistle. Well, again, they're both right answers. Tertius was obviously the scribe. Paul would dictate, where we would use the letter, and he'd have a scribe who would write it. We might surmise, again, kind of like reading Grandma's letters in the attic, that Tertius knew those people. And so he wanted, probably with Paul's permission, to put his own little note in there. Paul, can I tell them, you know, I know those people. Can I put my little note in here? And so he did that. And so Paul would dictate those things. But look at, now go to Colossians chapter 4. So it seemed to be the practice, and this wasn't just a biblical practice, this was a practice that was just done in that day, that you'd have a scribe who would write these things for you. As you would dictate to them, you'd tell them, right, we'd have a secretary take shorthand and go write it all down or type it up today. Or now we don't need shorthand anymore, do you? Some scribe would write this, but then something else would happen. Someone read Colossians 4, verse 18.
This salvation.
Oh. Go ahead, Marianne.
I, Paul, write this with you in my own hand. Remember, I am prisoner.
Okay. And so, a scribe, like Tertius or someone else, would do the actual pen work based upon the dictation of Paul. But Paul would often kind of write out the last little bit. Just like today, if you had a secretary who you dictated something to, they would type it all up, but you would sign it. Well, Paul would not only sign it, but he would write some little salutation. So when we get to Galatians 6, verse 11, "See with what letters I've written to you with my own hand," probably just means this part. Probably not the entire letter. Now, it could have been. Paul could have written the entire letter. We don't know. But he could be just saying, this part I've written, like he said in Colossians. This salutation I've written. The rest of it's in the handwork of the scribe. That may have been for a personal reason. It may have been some kind of authentication. That you know, here's my signature that you'll recognize. Now, again, we won't spend much time with this. Why did Paul say with large letters he had written this?
But sometimes when we print in large letters, it means we're shouting.
Yeah, yeah.
I don't know what it meant back then.
You know, yeah, it may be a vision. You remember chapter 4, verse 15? What then was the blessing you enjoyed? For I bear you witness, if possible, you'd have plucked out your own eyes and given. Remember, we talked then about that might have been Paul's thorn in the flesh, that his infirmity that he talks about here, that they would have plucked out their own eyes and given to him. So there may have been a vision problem, and he may have had the right big to see it. But as Foy indicated, I know in the New King James, my version of the New King James, in verse 11, has an exclamation point at the end of it. But that was added by the translators, but it may indicate large letters. I'm shouting, or I'm saying that for emphasis. Today, we would either put big letters or we put that exclamation point at the end. So, but anyway.
It was how much he had written. Like a long letter.
Oh.
It was a large letter.
Yeah.
The reason I would probably doubt that large letters mean that then is because of the statement that Paul made twice about when preaching any other gospel rather than large letters.
He repeats it. Yeah. That seemed to me more the custom then is to repeat yourself for emphasis' sake. Yeah, and he does that in Corinthians and in Galatians here.
The original manuscripts written in lowercase or uppercase?
Well, good question. The question was the original manuscripts. We don't have any of the we don't have any autographed copies. All we have are copies of copies of copies. But the most ancient manuscripts that we have were written in what's called the uncials, but for lack of a better way, it's all capital letters. And you talk about the difficulty. That's interesting to me, maybe not to you, but I'll throw it out there anyway. The translators and doing this, we did this something in the lesson. No punctuation, no periods, no commas, no colons, semicolons, no punctuation, all capital letters, and no spaces. Imagine translating that. That would be hard in English. If you speak English and read English, that'd be hard to do that in English. But imagine now you're going to a language that's a dead language, not your native tongue, therefore, and you're having to translate this out.
No spaces between the words?
No spaces between the letters of the words. Yeah, in the most ancient of manuscripts. Just the way they wrote. You know, it just seems odd to us, but seemed normal to them, I guess. So now, verse 12, as many as desire. So here's kind of his conclusion. You see, we want large letters. Again, maybe his main point of that, let's not miss his main point. This is me saying this. The Apostle Paul, by the inspiration of God. Here's my signature to that effect. As many as desire to make a good showing in the flesh. Now here he's going back to the theme of the book, these Judaizing teachers who were motivated by the fleshly desire to lord it over these people, plus the flesh here certainly may speak of the circumcision and the fleshly aspects of the law that they were demanding that these Christians, particularly the Gentile Christians, adhere to. And so he's talking about those false teachers, those Judaizing teachers who were making a desire to make a good showing in the flesh. He says, these try to compel you to be circumcised. They try to force you to be circumcised. So that goes back to really, again, to the theme and back to what he had said earlier. Remember in chapter 5, verse 2, he said, indeed, I, Paul, say to you that if you become circumcised, Christ will profit you nothing. Remember we made that point there that he wasn't talking about just the physical, surgical act of circumcision there. That if you were circumcised that you can't be a Christian. That's not what he's saying. We understand that. That he's talking about as a religious obligation. If you're teaching that you have to be circumcised in order and keep other parts of the law in order to be a good Christian, then Christ profits you nothing. And that's what he's saying here. They're trying to compel you as a religious obligation. It wasn't because of any kind of just a custom or any kind of medical or hygienic reasons. It was a religious reason. And he says that they're trying to compel you, and that was their making a good showing in the flesh. He says, only that they may not suffer persecution for the cross of Christ. He adds another twist there, doesn't he? That maybe at least part of the motivation. Now remember, at this stage, this was a very early epistle. And Well, let me just ask you this from your study of the book of Acts. Where did the initial persecution against Christians come from? The Jews. It progressed to include the Romans, didn't it? Nero and just the horrible things that he did. But it started with the Jews. You remember, it started with Stephen. And I really think that the stoning of Stephen was a watershed event for many reasons. Because what they did to Stephen was against the law. Remember that when they brought Jesus to Pilate, Pilate said, "You go judging yourself." And they said, "Well, we're not allowed to put him to death. That is, by the Roman law, we can't crucify him. We can't put him to death, but he's worthy of death. So that's why we're bringing him to you, Pilate." The Jews couldn't exact that kind of punishment on their own. It was against Roman law. And so Stephen put him to death, didn't they? The Jews stoned him. And I think probably what happened is that when that happened in kind of the heat of the moment. They got caught up in this mob mentality. Remember, they closed their ears and they rushed toward him, gnashed their teeth at him, and they probably went back home and went, "Uh-oh." Not that they regretted killing him because they didn't want to kill him, but they maybe regretted it because the Roman government was going to come and get us. But after a couple of days, nothing happened. The Roman government just kind of didn't care about it. And so then, that's in chapter 7. In chapter 8, it says, "Now there arose a great persecution against the church." I think the silence and the inaction of the Roman government gave the Jews courage. Okay, well, it's been a month now. Nothing's happened. And so the Roman government is kind of just winking at us and telling us it's okay. And so let's go full bore. And I truly believe that the evidence in the book of Acts shows that the stoning of Stephen just opened the floodgates for that. The Roman government didn't come in and punish them for doing that. And so they said then, "All right, let's go." And so that persecution started against from the Jews to against the Christians. This is one of the early epistles. And so maybe part of the motivation for the Judaizing teachers, or part of the sales pitch, if you will, was to these churches to say, "Now look, the Jews are persecuting us Christians terribly. If you'll do this, the Jews will leave you alone. If you'll compel these Gentiles to be circumcised, and you'll keep certain parts of the law of Moses, then the Jews will leave you alone." And you can see that. Now, don't misunderstand me, but you can see that being a good selling point, can't you? Now, it was just as wrong as can be, but from a worldly, selfish standpoint, you can see some of these Christians going, "Well, all right. I don't want to be stoned. I don't want to be put in prison." And maybe they weren't thinking about the spiritual implications, as he did in chapter 5, saying Christ is of no effect to you if you do that. You need to understand what you're doing. But from a sales standpoint, that made good sense. And so either the teachers themselves were motivated by that, or they were using that to motivate the others to do it. Here's the way that you can escape this persecution. Let's make the Jews happy. Let's kind of placate them, and they won't bother the churches that do this. Charles.
It's always been my understanding for a long time that the nations that the Romans took over or defeated, they took over, but they allowed them to have their own government or whatever, as long as it didn't interfere with Rome.
It didn't
matter if the Jews, whatever it was.
Right. Theirs was a peaceful taking over. As long as you behave.
They allowed them to practice.
Right, as long as it didn't interfere. Right. Yeah, that's what was called the Pax Romana, the Roman peace. It was kind of a non-military takeover in that sense. But you can see, and I think there's an application for us, unfortunately, maybe, that as persecution ramps up more and more against churches and against Christianity in general, we're already starting to see some of that, aren't we? And we're going to feel that, I believe, if not in our lifetime, in our children's lifetime, that if the Health and Drive Church of Christ won't appoint a woman preacher or a woman elder, or if we won't accept a homosexual into our midst, then we may have to, you know, My prediction is, I'm no prophet, but it'll probably start with taxes, that our tax status will go away. We'll have to start paying taxes on our contributions and then other things. And you can see where there would be a temptation, hopefully not among us, but among some, to say, well, okay, let's just do that. To escape the persecution. And so let's just appoint a woman preacher, or we'll accept the homosexuals in so that we won't face that persecution. A similar kind of idea here, kind of just watering it down so that you don't face that persecution. And so that applications can certainly be made, although we're not dealing with the same issue of circumcision and law, but there's an application there, isn't there? So they try to compel you to do this, only that they may not suffer persecution from the cross of Christ. That's one of their motives, Marianne.
Paul said in chapter 5 that if he went along with them, he wouldn't be persecuted.
Yeah, that was the proof that he wasn't teaching this, that I'm being persecuted for that. A good point that ties back to chapter 5. For, verse 13, for not even those who are circumcised keep the law. That is, those who are insisting, again, those who are circumcised here is the idea of those who are insisting on it as a religious obligation. They don't even keep the law. They're not consistent in that. But they desire to have you circumcised that they may glory in your flesh. Paul gets down to another motive here. The motive here is selfish. They want this attention. They want this following. Remember, it said even back as early as the time when Jesus was walking the earth that the Jews were envious of him because he was drawing these big crowds. They wanted that. They wanted this following. And so they're not just looking, they're really looking out for your spiritual interest. This is not just an issue of a different interpretation of a verse here or there. These people have terrible motives. He already said they come in stealthily. They're sneaking in. They're not sincere. They just try to avoid persecution, and they want the glory for themselves. They're not really trying to get you to keep the law. They're not keeping the law. What they're saying, what they're practicing, and what they're preaching is two different things. They're just wanting the glory for themselves. He had said back up in back in chapter 2, verse 14. Yeah, they're in chapter 5 that they compelled to do this. You've fallen from grace. Chapter 2, verse 14, he says, and when I saw that they were not straightforward about the truth of the gospel, I said to Peter before them all, if you, being a Jew, live in the manner of the Gentiles and not as the Jews, why do you compel Gentiles to live as the Jews? Even Peter, now, he's not putting Peter in this category that he's talking about in chapter 6, but even Peter wasn't keeping the law. He wasn't even teaching that you had to keep the law. But he was acting that way. Look at chapter 4, verse 17. Speaking of the false teachers now, he says, they zealous, Galatians 4, 17, they zealously court you, but for no good. Yes, they want to exclude you that you may be zealous for them. See, and we see this many times, don't we, in false teachers, that they have this ego trip, that they want this big following, and they have this selfish purposes, and so many times what goes along with it is that you have it as a means to somehow enrich that false teacher. Many times to enrich them financially, but maybe just to enrich their ego. And so they're doing this for their own selfish purposes, he said again, that they may glory in your flesh. They're not doing it because they want you to keep the law. They're not keeping the law. They're not doing it as a means to your salvation, a means to your righteousness. They're just doing it to boost themselves up. But, verse 14, but God forbid that I should glory. Remember, they're doing this to glory in your flesh. But God forbid that I should glory except in the cross of our Lord Jesus Christ. Paul says, what I'm doing is not to glory, bring glory to myself. What I'm doing is to bring glory to the cross. Now, we know that this is a figure of speech. We're so familiar with it, we don't even think of it as a figure of speech. But it's a figure of speech where one thing stands for another. And that's common in the Bible. We talk about in the Lord's Supper, the cup. Well, when the Bible talks about the cup, and we talk about the cup, Are we really talking about the cup, the container? No, we're talking about what's in the cup, aren't we? And when he's talking about the cross, is he really talking about the wooden object? No, that's a figure of speech. He's talking about the event that happened on a cross. He's talking about Jesus Christ and him crucified, as he'll say later. And so the figure of speech there takes the object to stand for what's associated with the object. When Jesus took the cup, blessed the cup, he didn't bless the container. He blessed the contents of the cup. When Paul says, I'm glorying in the cross, he wasn't glorying in a wooden cross. He was glorying in the crucifixion of Jesus Christ. And so I glory in the cross of Jesus. That's what I'm exalting. I'm not trying to exalt myself. I'm exalting Jesus Christ. By whom, he's going to talk about three deaths now in verse 14. By whom the world has been crucified to me. The first death was Jesus' death, the cross, the death of Jesus. The second death is that the world died to me. Now, and then I, he says, to the world. Dead here, we understand the word dead always has the same root meaning, but it's used in different senses. Sometimes we talk about spiritual death, sometimes we talk about physical death. And sometimes death means the idea of a decaying, but sometimes it means the idea of separation. James says that it's the body apart from the spirit is death, so faith without works is dead. There's a separation there. Sometimes death carries with it simply the idea of inactivity. We use the word that way sometimes, don't we? I've used this illustration before. Hopefully, no, this doesn't happen tonight. If somebody goes out in the parking lot to leave, they come back in and say, can somebody help me? My car's dead. What we mean, just it's inactive. It's not doing anything. And so sometimes the word simply means inactivity. Sometimes the word live or living means that in the Bible. Sometimes it's translated lively. A lively hope. It means an active hope. But here's the idea of death means the, kind of the separation. Again, we use the word, think about an expression that we use sometimes of maybe there's hurt feelings, so bad of hurt feelings that we just don't want anything to do with that person. Don't even mention their name to me, I would say. That person is what to me, I might say?
Dead.
They're dead to me. Well, that's what he means here. The world's dead to me. It doesn't appeal to me. I thought of this illustration today. I don't know if you've heard this or seen this. There is a sound that sometimes it's called a mosquito sound that you can look it up on your computer and play it. It's a very high-pitched, painful in your ears sound. But you can't hear it unless you're in your 20s or younger. If you're 40, 50, 60, you can't hear that sound. And so you can put that on your computer and play it. Do that when your grandkids are over sometime. Play that. You won't hear it. And they'll be going, what is that? It was actually invented to stop teenagers from loitering outside of a business. They would play that high-pitched sound, and old people would just walk right in and shop. But the young people would run away. And there's the idea is that your older ears are dead to that sound. It doesn't affect you at all. And that's the analogy that he's using here. The world has been crucified to me. Nothing's really happened to the world. The world hasn't been affected by the cross of Christ, unfortunately. But Paul is saying, it's dead to me. I don't hear it anymore. I don't hear that appeal that's drawing to it. The sound is still there. The temptation is still there. But I don't hear it. It's not affecting me. And what a powerful illustration he uses there. Paul.
I'd go to sleep now if the cricket's on the bed singing at the top of his voice. I don't even hear it.
Yep. There's some advantages to age, aren't there? You sleep better. Sometimes there's other things that get you awake in the middle of the night. So by whom the world is dead to me, and I'm dead to the world. And so the world doesn't have anything to do with me. I think it's a feeling that's mutual there. For in Christ Jesus, neither circumcision nor uncircumcision avails nothing or profits anything, but a new creation. Now, the new creation here could mean two different things. We normally think of the new creation. Paul in Colossians and in Romans talks about the Christian individually being a new creation. And that's probably what he's talking about. But he could be going back to his theme of saying, the idea of Christianity is the new creation. This is the fulfillment of the promise. The old law, the Mosaic law and its regulations, it wasn't the new creation. This is the new creation. The fulfillment of the promise is the new creation. So he could be meaning it in an individual sense, and probably is, that baptism into Christ makes us a new creature. That's what matters, not the fleshly act of circumcision. But there's the possibility that he's saying, this is the fulfillment of the promise. Christ in his church is the new creation. So that's a possibility, but I would again argue that he's probably talking about on the individual level, becoming a Christian, washing away your sins through the act of baptism. That's what matters, not the physical act of circumcision. And as many walk according to this rule, that is that circumcision means nothing, that it's being a new creature, as many walk according to this rule, peace and mercy be upon them and upon the Israel of God. I take it to mean that he's talking about one group there. That those who walk according to this rule are the Israel of God, the new Israel. I don't think he's there talking about ancient Israel or those who are Jews according to the flesh. I think according to the book, he's saying the new creation, the church, is the Israel of God. You're Israel now. Remember, he had said, you're the descendants of Abraham. You are those after Isaac. The old fleshly Israel is one after Ishmael. You're the new creation. You're the real Israel, the spiritual Israel. I take that to mean the same group. From now on, let no one trouble me. I think what he's saying there is, that's it. Hush. This deals with it. Don't question me as being an apostle. This should settle it. This is it. Let's stop this foolishness. Let's stop this false teaching and the accusation against me. For I bear in my body the marks of the Lord Jesus. I've got proof. And the proof is the persecution that the Jews are putting against me. Maybe a contrast there between the marks in the flesh with circumcision, which was a fleshly ordinance. Paul says, I've got my fleshly marks too. And it's the scars of persecution. But this, as somebody pointed out earlier, he said, I think Marianne said, earlier, that if I was preaching this, I wouldn't be persecuted. Here's the proof, he says. All right, appreciate your attention and participation in that. The book of Romans is going to be a perfect follow-up to this.